Hi, welcome to James Miller Lifeology. We learn to simplify and transform your spirit, mind, and body. My name is James Miller. I'm a licensed psychotherapist and a composer. Thank you so much for joining me today in this podcast. Let's get started. Today's episode is brought to you by Audible.com. Get your free audiobook and a free 30-day trial at www.audibletrial.com/James Miller Lifeology. I have a great show for you today. I'll be teaching you ways to identify 15 common thinking errors that can stop you from reaching your highest potential. I'll also be interviewing Kim Addis, who shares her transformational story and how she became a leader in life coaching and thought mastery. You all know me as a psychotherapist, but many of you do not know me as a composer. My first album, Consolation, was written specifically for people who are experiencing grief and loss. I like to think of this album like a book. Each original composition is written like a chapter in a book. And just like in any story, it goes from the loss that one experiences and eventually helps people find the hope for their future. You may purchase this album on iTunes or through any other digital music store. Be sure to download the digital booklet that comes along with it. The name of the album is Consolation, and my stage name is James S. Miller. The name of the piece you are currently hearing is entitled Temptation. As a man was passing a herd of elephants, he suddenly stopped, confused that these huge creatures were only held by a small rope tied to the front leg. It was obvious that these elephants could, at any time, break away from their bonds, but for some reason, they did not. He saw a trainer nearby and asked why the elephants just stood there and made no attempts to get away. "Well," the trainer said, "when they are very young, we use the same size rope to tie them, and at that age, it's easy enough to hold them. As they grow up, they are conditioned to believe they cannot break free. They believe the rope can still hold them, so they never try to break free." The man was amazed. These animals could at any time break free from their bonds, but because they believed they couldn't, they were stuck right where they were. Like the elephants, how many of us go through life hanging on to a belief that we can't do something simply because we failed at it once before? Identifying your primary thinking error. A few episodes back, we talked about core beliefs. Core beliefs are essentially the childhood templates we create, which help us understand how we fit in the world. And then as we become adults, we then use that childhood template to understand the world around us. And depending on the core beliefs we have, we'll determine how successful we will be. In psychology, we talk about ways in which our thoughts affect our actions or our behaviors. And the way it works is this. The core belief you have is going to be the perception that you use about any situation you're in. Your perception or your thoughts then determine what your emotions are going to be. Your emotions then act out by the behaviors that you demonstrate. So whatever you perceive affects your emotions, which affects your actions. What we often don't realize is that can happen so fast. And when it happens so fast, we often don't understand that we have a choice to react however we feel is the healthiest for us. And so that's where thinking errors come in. The psychological term is cognitive distortions, but for this lesson, we'll just call it thinking errors. Based on the childhood templates that we create, which are our core beliefs, we'll determine the types of thinking errors that you use. And one of the main reasons why I really wanted to focus on this specifically today, it does not matter what situation you're in today. It can be from the most mundane thing to one of the most traumatic things you've ever done. A thinking error can be present in any situation you're in. A little disclaimer for this particular lesson is I'm focusing on the second part of the interview with Kim Addis and not her personal journey. One way that I really like to help my clients understand how to be aware of a thinking error is to maybe even after the fact, recognize if you were being overreactive or your reaction was greater than what the situation warranted. I like to use scales. On a scale of 1 to 10, 10 is the most emotive or most emotional you are, and 1 would be the least emotional. Let's say a situation happens and you should probably demonstrate a certain emotion at a level 5, but you respond at a level 8. Well, that difference there is really a thinking error that was used, which caused you to be more reactive or more emotional than probably what you really would have done had you thought it through a little bit more. It's really necessary for us always to develop this insight of, and like I said, it could be after the fact, is if I overreacted, well, then what thinking error was I using? Why did I overreact? And it doesn't necessarily mean we have to know all the reasons why, but when we can look at these thinking errors and kind of have an idea of what they are, it helps us be much more effective and be able to recognize when a thinking error happens, so therefore we don't do it again. As we all know, with these lifeology lessons I teach, I really want you to have the ability to be as proactive as possible, as opposed to being reactive, as sometimes we can be, which doesn't allow us to enjoy life to its fullest. So there are essentially 15 major thinking errors that we all at sometimes use. Sometimes we use a lot more. Sometimes we have a go-to thinking error, which is often related to the core belief that we have about ourselves. So I'd like to share them with you today. And when you hear them, listen to see if this makes sense for you, or perhaps you did that today, or that may be your go-to thinking error. Unfortunately, I won't have enough time in this episode to go through each of the thinking errors like I'd like to. But I actually wrote an article on this. So if you go to my website, jamesmillerlifeology.com, and in the article section, there is an article there called Thinking Errors, and it goes through each of them in detail. Earlier, I mentioned how our core beliefs determine the types of thinking errors that we have. And remember, the way the thinking errors influence our perception, which then determines what we feel, which then determines what we do. So think of a thinking error like a lens or a film that you put over something. And depending on the color of the lens will determine how you see something. At the very beginning of your perception, when you take in all the details around you, and that's when most people use a thinking error. That perception is going to be tainted with that lens, if you will, or that film that goes over it, which then filters through to tell our thoughts what to think, which tell our emotions what to feel, which tells our body what to do. The first thinking error is filtering. Filtering is essentially you focus on one negative event, and that becomes the snapshot for the whole situation. For example, I had a horrible week because I got into an argument with someone. Well, that's not really true, because the only thing that was really negative or that you're focusing on was that argument. But there's so much more about the week that was enjoyable. Number two, polarized thinking, or in other words, black and white thinking. There is really no shades of gray. When we look at a situation or we perceive it to be a certain way, it's either this or that. It's either good or it's bad. A person meant to do something or they did not mean to do something. And so we often don't find grace for the people around us, or we don't allow for situations to maybe have another viewpoint because we're very rigid in the way we think. It's either this or that. Number three, overgeneralization. This particular thinking error specifically focuses on if one negative thing happens one time, we automatically think it's going to happen again. Just like the story that I told at the beginning of this episode, it's the same type of thing. If we failed one time, we all of a sudden think that we're going to fail every single time. Or if someone treats us a certain way, that then becomes a snapshot of how they're always going to treat us. Number four, jumping to conclusions. With this particular one, we like to feel as if we know why people are acting the way they're acting towards us or what their motivation was behind it. And we really don't try and figure out why they're acting that way. We just assume that we understand why. And when we don't try and figure it out or even ask them, then we act as if they are negative towards us. And then all of a sudden, we've created some argument or drama that really wasn't there in the first place. Number five, catastrophizing. This one here specifically focuses on the worst case scenario. We automatically think what the worst case scenario is going to be, and then we believe it's going to happen. So all the what if questions bombard our mind, and that's how we respond with crisis and catastrophe when nothing even happened. And the likelihood of the worst case scenario actually happening is pretty minimal. Number six, personalization. There are actually two sides of personalization. In other words, how it's demonstrated. One side of personalization is the person will assume that everything that happens around them, good or bad, is because of something they've done. Someone may say something and it's about that person. A situation may happen and it's because this person did a certain action. They assume as if they are the center of pretty much how the world works, and they are the foundation of everything that happens, good or bad. The other side of personalization is comparing yourself to the other person. Is the other person smarter? Are they more successful? Are they more attractive? Are they smarter than you? And in doing that, it can become a negative self-fulfilling prophecy when we're already feeling badly about ourselves. Number seven, control fallacies. There are also two versions of this as well, externally controlled and internally controlled. The externally controlled version of this thinking error is essentially the person doesn't take responsibility for their actions because they blame everybody else for why they're acting the way they're acting. And then the internal version of that is they often think that they're responsible for everything around them. So if they find that someone around them isn't very happy, they'll internalize it to think that they're to blame for it, as if they assume responsibility for the pain and happiness of everyone around them. If someone isn't happy, it's because of something they've done. Number eight, fallacy of fairness. This particular thinking error focuses on what is considered fair. A person believes they understand what fairness looks like, and if it doesn't happen, they become resentful. In other words, they may do a certain chore and expect the other person to do another chore, and when that doesn't happen, they assume it's not fair, and then all of a sudden there's a conflict between them. So their assumption of what is fair when it doesn't happen is going to cause a lot of resentment that eventually will spill over into their personal life. Number 9, blaming. This one focuses on we blame everybody else for why we feel the way we do. It's kind of like the control fallacy, but the control fallacy is more about behaviors, where blaming is more about emotions. We blame other people for our sadness, for our depression, for all the negative emotions that we feel we're experiencing. Number 10, shoulds. This particular one focuses on when we use the word, I should do this, or they should do this, or they ought to do this, or they must do this. We have this ironclad set of rules of how we feel we or others should behave, and when other people don't do it, we become very angry with them. And then when we don't do it, we feel really guilty because we violated our own set of rules. We often feel we have to motivate ourselves with these shoulds or should nots, as if we have to punish ourselves in order to motivate ourselves. Number 11, emotional reasoning. This one focuses on what we feel must be true. If we feel stupid about something, then we are stupid. We assume that our unhealthy emotions reflect the way we really are. So in other words, if I feel it, therefore it must be true. Number 12, fallacy of change. We expect that other people will change to suit our needs if we just pressure or cajole them enough. We need to change people because our hopes for happiness seem to depend entirely on them and not ourselves. Number 13, global labeling. This is really a form of stereotyping. We may see a certain demographic and all of a sudden assume everybody is like them, or a certain behavior manifests and we assume everything that's like that is going to be just like that. And that is really a form of prejudice and where stereotyping comes from. Number 14, always being right. This particular distortion focuses on a person always has to be right. It doesn't matter at what cost, they're going to prove themselves to be right. They may hurt many people in the arguments, but their whole goal is to prove how smart they are, how right they are, how wrong the other person is. And the last one is heaven's reward fallacy. We expect our sacrifices and self-denial to eventually pay off, as if someone is keeping score. So that's really what it boils down to. We're keeping score, and when we do something more for the other person, then they in kind will do the same amount of things for us too. And then we become very resentful and angry when it doesn't happen. Remember, how a thinking error works is they are the lens which directs our thoughts, emotions, and our feelings and how we're going to interact with others. Anytime there's a conflict, anytime someone overreacts in a situation, anytime you are feeling something that's greater than maybe what the situation warrants, a thinking error has been invoked. It's important for each of us to be aware of this. If we're overcome with anxiety, with adversity, or anything that's happening in our life, if we use one of those thinking errors, it's going to make the situation worse. And the more often we use a thinking error, the more it's going to hinder us from becoming the person that we want to be, from reaching our highest potential. So I'd really encourage you today, if you're finding that you're having conflict, either internally or externally, figure out which thinking error you're using, because I can guarantee you, you are using one of them. And now, a quick word from my sponsor. Audible.com is offering you, my listener, a free audiobook and a free 30-day trial at audibletrial.com/JamesMillerLifeology. Many of you don't know this about me, but I'm an avid reader, so this is a no-brainer for me to go ahead and download any audiobook I'd like to read, specifically if I'm walking my dog, at the gym, or just even driving. So for you to get your free audiobook, go to audibletrial.com/JamesMillerLifeology. They have over 180,000 books for you to choose from, so I'm pretty confident you'll find the one you're looking for. So check it out today. I have the pleasure of introducing Kim Addis. She is a president and founder of Frame of Mind Coaching and Journal Engine Software. She is an author, speaker, entrepreneur, coach, and mother of five. Kim is one of North America's foremost experts on performance through thought mastery and mental focus. She will be sharing her inspirational story with us today. Thank you so much for joining with us today, Kim.
I am really excited to be here. I'm looking forward to having this conversation.
I am too. Now, you have done quite a few things in your life. You know, I know a little bit of your backstory of you were the owner of one company and then you had some transformations in your life and now the foremost speaker in one of these other areas. But I would like for you to share with my listeners how you were able to navigate to this new venture. So what were the things that were happening in your life to cause you to have a life change?
I used to own another company. It was called Upward Motion. Mm-hmm. Pretty cool name. And we used to help companies make better hiring decisions by running them through simulation-based assessments. So we created assessments. We had a software company.
Okay.
And I had three partners. One of them is now my ex-husband.
Okay.
And so that was definitely one of the toughest times in my life. The business really thrived. It succeeded. We became known, particularly in the real estate industry, as one of the top assessment tools at the time anyway. And so we had a really great run. But when our marriage fell apart, at the beginning, we thought that perhaps we could still work together. But that was quickly discovered that that was a terrible idea.
Sure. That was an ambitious goal, but sounds like a very difficult goal nonetheless.
A very difficult goal. And shortly thereafter, I mean, things were just so tense. It was impossible to be in the office. It was like I remember feeling just a sense of my heart was beating fast all the time. I didn't feel well. I always felt like a sense of illness coming over my physical body. And one of the things that I did as I was going through that period in time was that I journaled, and there was a lot going on. There were a lot of moving parts. One is all of a sudden I found myself to be a single mom with two kids. I found myself working with my ex-husband. I found myself dealing with him moving on to another relationship. I found myself confronting the dating scene, and God knows I didn't have much experience in that area.
Sure.
So there were a lot of things going on. And the worst of it was this crazy tension that existed in the office. And slowly, slowly, we kind of came to the realization that we just can't even be in the same space together.
Mm-hmm.
It's just too tough. And so at that time, he asked me to find a buyer so that he could leave. That business was really my creation. I gave birth to it, you could say.
Sure.
I looked for a buyer. I found a buyer. The buyer was willing to give him his price. But when it came time to negotiating with me, he gave me a terrible deal.
Oh, no.
I decided to pull the plug. I didn't want to be in that relationship. I didn't want to have them as partners. I felt like I was being bullied and taken advantage of. And so I just said no. And my ex-husband was not happy with that because he got the price that he wanted. Then he came back to me and he said, fine, then you buy me out. Again, I had to go get a mortgage. Like, I had to put my financial life on the line in order to make this work. And I made him an offer that would allow me to pay him like 1 year at a time over a 5-year period.
Mm-hmm.
And he just looked at it and he said, I'm not even entertaining this deal. Like, this is insane. I can't, you know, like compared to what he just got. Right.
Yeah.
And so he said, give me a shotgun deal. And for those of you who are listening, who have never heard the term shotgun, what that is if I want to buy someone out, I say, okay, here's the price I'm willing to pay. And if they don't like that price, they buy you out at that rate.
Oh,
so
okay.
Like I gathered all my resources. And I went to the bank. I spoke to my bank manager. I said, okay, like, here's the maximum I'm able to put down in one shot. Because he didn't want to get paid out over time.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted to get paid out right away. I felt really uncomfortable. I had all kinds of self-doubt. I wasn't even sure if I'd be able to run the company without him. It was, like, so many factors involved. And when I gave him the shotgun and he saw my price, it was maybe at, I don't know, 80% of the original price that he got from the other potential sale. What he ended up doing is he went back to that guy who wanted to buy him out. He partnered with him, came back to me and said, I'm buying you out.
Oh my gosh.
It was an extremely dramatic time in my life.
Oh my gosh, Kim.
I was in my office at the time and he gave us the shotgun papers, and basically, you know, I had 2 hours to vacate the premises. And
oh, that's so traumatic.
It was crazy. It was just a crazy, crazy time. And so I remember packing up my stuff in boxes and leaving with tears streaming down my face as he literally held the door for me.
Especially since that was your creation. That was something that you said you gave birth to that company. That
exactly.
Was your pride and joy. That was your identity. There was so many things that you had invested in that. And so
exactly.
It's compounded, not only the marriage aspect, but your identity when it comes to your work. I mean, all those things have been stripped away from you.
Well, that's exactly it, actually. You hit the nail on the target when you say my identity.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went home and I was like, I was just a mess. And I remember my kids going like, what's wrong? And I said, your dad just fired me. And I, like, it was the wrong thing to say. Wow. It was just horrible, bad positioning. It was just terrible. But I was so distraught.
Of course.
Didn't know how else to put it. And those are words that I regret to this day. But I was in such a bad place. I didn't know how else to express it. I had to figure out who I was. I had to see, so you know, you're asking about what lessons did I learn? Well, one lesson I learned is that I am not my business and my business is not my identity.
Good for you.
That was a huge lesson. Yeah. And it was a hard-earned lesson.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing I learned was how to get up after you've been what felt like kicked to the ground. Now, at this point, I don't want to remove my responsibility from that experience. I was 100% responsible for the unfolding of that experience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I couldn't handle the pressure. I needed to get out. I didn't have the resilience at the time, the calm, the peacefulness to handle the storm. I didn't have it at the time. Every time I would walk into the office and would see him there, like I would literally feel like I was sick, that I would have a nervous breakdown.
Mm-hmm.
I needed to get out. And at this point now, like I can handle that type of stress much, much better.
You have a baseline now as well. So you've been through that position. Hopefully you'll never be through it again. But now you have that baseline and then you know that you have that resilience should something like that happen again.
Exactly. If somebody wants to show up and be miserable, that's their deal. It's
mm-hmm.
not mine. I have the ability to handle stress so much better now.
Mm-hmm.
While I was going through all that and really, you know, how did I get back up? How did I recover? How did I get to the next thing? How did I figure out how to raise my kids? How did I do all those things? I did a lot of personal work. I read a lot of books. I got back on the horse really fast, even though it wasn't necessarily the right horse to be on. I was moving instead
mm-hmm.
of sinking in quicksand. I just kept going. I just kept moving. I got hired very shortly thereafter, about 4 or 5 weeks later, I got hired to be the vice president of a company that does coaching here
locally
in Toronto. And I thought, wow, this is perfect for me. But I slowly started to learn that their coaching approach and methodology was not exactly what I felt was an appropriate coaching style. And really that helped me to create my own thinking
mm-hmm.
and evolve my own business approach and strategy and coaching process as a result of that.
Wonderful. Let's jump back for a second here. Maybe difficult to discuss, but when you first went home and you were so overwhelmed and so hurt and so rejected, those are my words, not yours, when that situation happened, you know, when you were bought out, how did you find the perspective to say, all right, my options are I move forward or I sink in quicksand, like you said? How did you start to find that resilience? How did you start to find the upward movement?
I kept in touch with some of my close friends and that was helpful. Like they just were a bit of, you know, an anchor for me. They were
mm-hmm.
just a bit of, you know, a safe haven for me to fall into. So that was good. And I journaled. Honestly, I journaled morning, noon, and night. One of the things that I wanted when I had come to the conclusion that I was getting divorced was that I wanted to go through that process with as much grace and dignity as I could muster.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to tell you, and for anybody who's listening right now, that's sometimes really hard to muster.
I'm sure.
I would journal, and really the journaling would be about me expressing the angst, the frustration, the disappointment, all those things that you described. It was
mm-hmm.
about me unloading. But then at the end of my journal, I would always, always take the time to say, okay, so, you know, there's all this horrible, bad, terrible stuff happening, but what do I want? Where do I want to go? What kind of relationship do I want to have? What kind of job do I want to have? What do I want to create for myself? What kind of mother do I want to be? And how do I want to feel? And I would spend a good chunk of my journal always, always taking the time to point myself towards what I wanted to have instead of what I was currently experiencing. And I have to say that that was like a source of oxygen for me.
Mm-hmm.
That kept me grounded. That kept me focused. That kept me up part of the time instead of down all of the time.
Well, it also instills a sense of hope as well, because if we can be forward thinking even a little bit, that creates that glimmer of hope. It doesn't mean that we believe that what we're writing about is going to come true, but it starts to instill that and it causes our mind to tilt or to shift in that direction of potentially this could happen, or maybe this could happen, or I hope this happens. And that allows for people not to become so overly consumed with all the current situation. And I think that's wonderful that you were able to end each of your journal sessions with something like that.
Right. And I remember speaking to my uncle at the time, who had his own kind of share of adversity. And I remember him saying, it doesn't matter what your next step is. It doesn't matter if your next step isn't perfect. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter if the next job isn't the most ideal job. It matters that you're moving.
Exactly.
He didn't say it quite as eloquently, I have to say. but
that's the gist of it.
Yeah. It left an impression. And I thought to myself, okay, I just got to like get onto a new project, a new job, a new mm-hmm. whatever. And so I started to do that almost instantly.
How are you able to compartmentalize each of those things? Because when you're going, or when anybody's going through so many things, I mean, you are hit in pretty much every area of your life, your finances, your marriage, your career, your personal life, all those things were hit at once. How were you able to compartmentalize potentially each of those topics as you were journaling?
My financial life was positively affected.
Oh, well, I guess that's true, yeah.
Okay. Right, I sold my shares and all of a sudden, you know, I found myself with all this extra money and I'm like, whoa, mm-hmm. I've never been so wealthy in my life.
that's good then.
And that actually gave me some measure of freedom to start to kind of just do things and spend money, I guess, in ways to figure some stuff out. And honestly, I did a lot of strange things. I experienced a lot of different courses and classes, and I traveled and I met some interesting people, and I just started to understand that I have an opportunity here to really experiment and try things that I've never tried before. My life was affected, and one of the greatest ways that it was affected was in the area of parenting. So all of a sudden I found myself at that time, anyways, was a while ago, the mother of two kids, and I had to share custody. And one of the most difficult parts for me was that I knew that my kids weren't necessarily happy at their fathers. Mm-hmm. And I had more old-fashioned parents who kept telling me, well, kids should be with their mother. And so I had so much guilt, so much guilt at the time. It was probably the hardest part of the whole entire thing, day in and day out, wondering why I wasn't strong enough, why I didn't have the fortitude to just take my kids full time. And, you know, I knew that it wasn't a fight I wanted to engage in. I got a good piece of advice at one point. Someone told me, look, you know, drop the fight. Don't even think about it. When you think about your kids, just focus on being the most amazing mom you can be. Just exactly. Be an amazing mom.
Because that's what you can control.
Exactly. And that made a huge, huge difference for me. And slowly, slowly over time, they ended up being with me full time anyways. Mm. But it was without struggle. It was without a battle.
And I think that's a thing. When we put on the additional emotional snapshot or the emotional version of that, you know, you said as far as the strength and the fortitude, there's nothing wrong with striving to be that. But when we feel it's a deficit within us, then it can take away from our ability to be as effective as we can be. Because then all of a sudden we have this additional guilt and shame that goes along with that. And it's actually more of a hindrance than it is helpful for us.
Well, it's terrible. It's, you know, it's like a noose around your neck. It feels like you're in quicksand and you just don't know how to get out of that feeling. Mm-hmm. It's a horrible feeling.
Yes. So you were the vice president of this coaching company, this coaching firm. How did you come to the realization that perhaps their methodology was different than yours?
For starters, I'm a bit of a serial entrepreneur. And so first and foremost, I'm just not designed to work for others. It's mm-hmm. just not part of my DNA. I have a lot of kind of ideas and ways of thinking that aren't necessarily the norm. They don't go with the way the world works. Mm-hmm. One of the biggest things was that I saw how coaching was done, and it was heavily based on the accountability model of coaching. I don't know if you're familiar with that model.
I am, but my listeners are not.
Okay, so in the accountability model, when you hire a coach, you have a very specific goal you want to reach. And the job of the coach is to help you create a plan and break that plan down into manageable components so that you can reach your goal, and hold you accountable for every action item that takes you closer to the goal. As I saw that being played out in that company, I thought to myself, there's something wrong with that plan. My feeling is that most people know what to do. They can create a plan. They can access plans. There are clues in past successes
yes.
that we can access, especially with the internet and Google. People know what to do. They're not doing it, though. What's up with that? And I thought to myself, if I look very carefully at the reason why people don't take the actions that they know will lead them to success, what I find is that people hold a set of beliefs that get in their way. That people think in ways that prevent them from being successful. Most coaching programs are structured around the concept of massive action, mm-hmm. taking action. You can't reach a goal if you're not going to take action. In coaching, we help you take action. For me, I thought, I don't really actually have to help people take action, because if people's thinking is lined up with their goals, they naturally take action.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
What I need to do is help people identify where their thinking is interfering with their ability to take action. And I have to help them clear that up and just move out of their way after mm-hmm. that. I don't have to hold them accountable. They don't have to answer to me. I've often said that the accountability model is unethical at best and detrimental at worst. And people say, well, what does that mean? And here's what it means is, if I were coaching you and the accountability model worked, in other words, you moved forward, you made progress, you answered to me, and you got stuff done, what happens when I leave? What I've done is I've actually created a little bit of a dependency. And that's not very ethical, certainly not in the coaching world. But if you're struggling on your own and you're trying to reach your goals and you're not able to make it happen, and then you hire a coach and for whatever reason you're still not able to make it happen, how do you feel now?
Yeah.
You feel worse.
It's compounded. Sure.
Right. It's compounded. So the very reason you came to me in the first place is exactly that. It's compounded. It's exacerbated. It's made worse. And so from my perspective, I'm not serving the client at all. Mm-hmm. I'm just making them feel worse. I'm making them feel more guilty, less capable, and more ashamed.
Sure.
And so I've added to the weight of their problem instead of alleviating it.
Yeah.
So for me, the accountability model is just all wrong. That's where it really started. And I looked at it and I said, we're trying to get the dog to wag his tail by grabbing the tail and shaking instead of looking at how a person thinks and really addressing that first. And the concept here is that thought precedes action. So let's identify the thoughts that are productive and the thoughts that are not so productive. And let's help people make sure that most of their thoughts are productive so that they can make progress with greater ease.
That's absolutely wonderful. You know, in the psychology world, and maybe you use some of that as well in your company, but we have what's called cognitive distortions. Cognitive distortions are essentially the template we've used to understand the world. So we've created whatever we believe to be true about ourselves. When that cognitive distortion kicks in, it often tells us, well, I can't do this because of this particular reason. And so it doesn't allow for us to be successful. And pretty much we all have a version of a cognitive distortion in some areas of our life. And so when you can really navigate that and strip away what that distortion is, there's a whole world of possibility for you. And so it's so wonderful to hear that perhaps you do it in a different way, but it is true. The motivation for why we do what we do, or the success that we encounter, is always going to be because our perception of self, our perception of where we fit in the world, and that's when we can become actionable. That's when we can do those things. So that's wonderful that you were able to help your clients with that.
So one of the things that we do when we work with clients is we ask them to journal. So yeah, and so it's a huge part of what we do. And the reason we do that is because the journaling allows us to see how people think in different circumstances, in different environments, with different challenges over time. And it allows us to identify the patterns where they get stuck.
Mm-hmm.
And have those cognitive distortions over and over and over again.
Mm-hmm. If I'm understanding this correctly, so in every area of their life where they've been successful or where they had difficulties, you create a background or snapshot of how they dealt with it and what their thoughts were, their thought patterns, and then you're able to maybe even create like a, if you will, a personality profile of where their pitfalls are, where they're struggling. Is that correct?
Well, we certainly go a little bit into history, but we're also working with the right now. So
okay.
What's going on right now? Share the conversation you just had with your spouse or your colleague or whatever, whoever,
mm-hmm.
right? Share what's going on that's causing you to feel stress. What's causing you to feel like you're putting out fires all the time? What's happening? And how is that making you feel? And what we're seeing is a train of thought.
Mm-hmm.
And where that train of thought comes from. And from that, we're able to unearth a set of beliefs that really hold dominion over a person's behavior.
Sure. Which then can limit them from being successful.
Exactly. We go to the past, but we definitely deal in the present
mm-hmm.
as well. And we connect the dots, of course, because the past often informs our present. And
yes.
So, you know, mostly we're in the present, though.
When you've created this new venture, how were you able to maybe think back on your own life, you know, a few years prior to that or whenever the situation took place? How were you able to then say, wow, the journaling when I did it helped me so much. And now I can take my past experience. And of course, you didn't want to go through that situation, but you were, and you found something that worked for you. And then since you're a serial entrepreneur, like you said, you were able to link those things together. And now you have a successful business based off of something you did for yourself when you went through that traumatic time. Do you often think about that, that comparison of where you were and how you got through that and how it's helped you be so successful today?
Well, now I know the relationship really between journaling sure. and the ability to help a person navigate towards success. But at the time when I started Frame of Mind Coaching, I wasn't able so much to put the pieces together. And I'm being completely honest and transparent. When I thought about coaching, I thought, you know, we need to coach differently. We need to really look at thoughts. And I thought to myself, I have an instinct. I have a feeling that I could be a really good coach, but I've never coached anybody a day in my life. And I'm terrified. One of the last things that, or the biggest things that I was fearful of was, what happens if I coach people and I'm not effective? What happens if I have no impact? What happens if they coach with me and then like a month or two later, they've forgotten everything? So I really wanted more than anything to be a coach that made a massive difference, not a little difference, a massive difference. And that was my driver. And so I thought to myself, how do we make sure that every call is super powerful? How do we make sure that we have something to talk about on every single call? Mm-hmm. And that's when the idea of journaling came to me. And I thought to myself, if they journaled and I had the ability to read their journals. So in other words, they journal, I read and respond to their journals in between every call. Mm-hmm. Then when the call came, we would have a lot to talk about. We would be able to go very deep, very quickly. And so the journaling was there in my coaching strategy as a means to increase my strength or to equip me as a coach. Mm-hmm. Over time, I started to realize the impact of journaling on the client with or without me.
And when doing that, then obviously then they're not going to be dependent on you because you've created a process that works for them. So let's say they're no longer a client of yours. They will be able to do this and navigate this on their own without that dependence that you saw in your previous company.
Exactly. And part of our mandate is to equip our clients with the tools, the strategies, the techniques, the principles, the framework to be able to really start to observe their own thinking and notice when their thinking is playing tricks on them and working against them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's wonderful. It sounds like you're very successful with that.
We love it. I have a team of coaches. We coach some of the most interesting, dynamic, successful people in the world. And, you know, for me, I coach people and I have an impact on them, but there's no question that they have an impact on me.
Oh, that's wonderful. And I like that symbiotic relationship, if you will, in the sense of you're able to help them, but it also helps you as well. I mean, I think in anything, you know, if I'm talking to someone or you're talking to someone, we all learn from each other. And so learning what perhaps worked for someone else, you're like, oh, you know, that's interesting. You know, I'm gonna think about that later. I'm going to put that on the back shelf for myself to maybe assimilate into my life as well. In life in general, in every situation we're in, there's always a lesson. And I think whether we're the professional or we're the client, we're always going to learn something.
There's always a lesson. And I want to say that one of the things I teach my coaches all the time is, we coach others so that we could stay sharp. Mm-hmm. And we coach them because every time we coach someone else, we're providing coaching for ourselves.
Yes.
And so we are the primary beneficiaries of the coaching experience. Mm-hmm. And our clients, of course, are the secondary beneficiaries. And so you would think it's the opposite way around. You know, you hear people who are coaches and you ask them, why do you coach people? Well, because I like to serve others. And I will tell you that yes, we do serve others and we do a phenomenal job of serving others. But unless we're clean and clear ourselves, we're not doing such a good job.
Sure.
It's a huge component of coaching.
That is wonderful. Well, Kim, I want to thank you so much for being on my show today. If my listeners would like to find out more information about you and about your coaching business, where would they find your information online?
The best place to find us is frameofmindcoaching.com. And I want to invite anyone who's listening to look around on the website. One of the things I strongly encourage is for people to take the frame of mind coaching assessment. And what that is it allows you to see what your thinking is doing right now. Is it working for you? Is it working against you? Where are you in your life? What's going on? And really take a moment to take a snapshot of what's happening for you. There's an opportunity in that assessment to do a little bit of journaling and experience that component of our coaching experience with a coach who will review it with you.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. That's great that you have that opportunity for people who are able to visit your website.
It's a great experience. A lot of people will say that that one review made a huge difference in their lives.
Very impactful. Well, Kim, once again, thank you so much for being on my show. And it has been a pleasure getting to know you.
It's been an awesome conversation. I feel like I shared the depths of my soul here.
That's wonderful.
But thank you so much for the opportunity. It was really a pleasure to talk to you, and I look forward to reading and hearing your notes afterwards. I'm excited about that.
Wonderful. Well, thank you once again.
Thank you.
I also want to thank you, the listener, for joining with me today. Please subscribe to this podcast through whichever podcast portal you joined with me. If you're using iTunes and you like what you hear, please rate this podcast as well as leave your comments on the iTunes podcast page. Also, please visit my website where you may see all my YouTube episodes and published articles I've written for you. You may also enroll in the Lifeology Academy I created where you can take self-directed courses which are designed for successful people just like you. You may find all this information at jamesmillerlifeology.com. Once again, thank you so much for listening to this podcast episode today. Have a fantastic week, and I look forward to talking to you very soon.